This episode of The Dig is sponsored by our Patreon supporters and by Oxford University Press, which publishes a lot of excellent work, including books by guests on this show. Today, I want to tell you about The Politics of Immigration, Partisanship, Demographic Change, and American National Identity by Tom K. Wong. Wong analyzes more than 30,000 congressional votes in immigration policy, examining the increasingly partisan divide and the role played by immigrant residents in shaping policy. It also provides an excellent, concise overview of American immigration politics and makes for a handy reference guide. The Politics of Immigration, Partisanship, Demographic Change, and American National Identity. You can save 30% on Oxford University Press politics books with the coupon code DIG30, that's DIG30. Some exclusions apply. Visit oup.com/academic. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Under Trump, the media has become a part of the story like never before. Journalist probing has irritated our touchy president and, in response, been labeled the opposition party and the enemy of the American people, accused of peddling fake news. Media outlets have also, however, played a critical role in Trump's rise. During the campaign, cable news provided him with wall-to-wall free advertising. And for years, many in the media have broken their trust with readers and viewers, laundering the Bush administration's case for war in Iraq in 2003, and, more recently, lauding Trump as presidential because he decided to attack Syria.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield. What did they hit? What are you convinced?
More generally, the fact that most reporters didn't see Trump coming was not just a failure of political journalism or polling methodologies. Rather, it reflected a troubling groupthink developed in the moneyed cocoons of New York and Washington. From there, everything looked fine. For many Americans, however, everything was going to hell, and fast. I can't think of anyone better at quickly cutting through the horrors and banalities of mainstream media spin than Adam Johnson, a writer for the leftist press watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Johnson also is a frequent contributor to The Nation and the Los Angeles Times. Adam Johnson, welcome to The Dig.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for coming. So Bill O'Reilly, who has perhaps done more than anyone else in this country to turn it into an ideological Superfund site with his toxic rants, is also a serial sexual harasser, allegedly, and is out at Fox. What's your obit?
Bill O'Reilly was known for having the eldest demographic in all of cable news, including Fox News. And as anyone who grew up in a household that watched Fox News, as I did, and had, had elderly relatives and grandparents who watched Bill O'Reilly religiously, you saw a transformation take place. I think that it's hard to pin those things down, but I do think that he was, you know, on the vanguard of a very kind of sophisticated propaganda machine that we, you know, we sort of took it for granted because it's been around so long, but it really has had a very lasting damaging effect on people. And it's too little too late, but I guess it's good he's gone. He's been a purveyor of white supremacy, of incitement to violence against abortion doctors, of spreading myths about welfare queens, handouts, all that good stuff. So it's a shame it took 20 years, I guess, but it's I'm glad that he's off the air.
I take it that you don't think that Fox News is about to become a dramatically less horrible place, though?
No, they'll just – they'll just replace him with some other hack. I would argue that maybe it's slightly better since they won't be as kind of popular. But you know, he'll keep selling his Mick history written by someone else, and probably get some sort of radio show. I think probably that's my guess. So he won't go away, but at least he's on Fox.
Turning to more mainstream media, recently Brian Williams on MSNBC was so moved by Trump's attack on Assad's airbase that he seemed to be having an on-air orgasm, citing Leonard Cohen entirely unironically. The media response generally seems to have been that Trump is acting presidential by bombing another country, which in a twisted sense is right in a way. There's nothing more in line with what U.S. presidents do than bomb other countries. Tell me a little bit about the media response to the Syria attack and what we should learn from it.
I mean, you know, presidents, like anything else, they respond to stimuli, and they see what the media likes and doesn't like. And his attack on the Syrian military base was almost uniformly accepted as being good, because regime change or some military action against Syria has been something that has been conventional wisdom within the national security circles for several years now. Obama was a bit of an outlier in that he pursued regime change via CIA, Contras, and proxies to the tune of about $1 billion a year, but sort of refused to do the direct military action because he sort of his foreign policy is kind of a let the CIA do what they want, but we don't want to get the DOD involved. There's lots of theories as to why that is. Probably the most popular is that the DOD thought a regime change in Syria would have been a total nightmare, and they're probably right. So when Trump did a 180 on Syria and decided to bomb the Assad government, that was praised as a radical shift that was to put him more in line with the conventional wisdom and more in line with what Hillary Clinton would have done and what Marco Rubio would have done, both of whom supported a no-fly zone in Syria, which is, of course, bombing the Syrian Air Force. It's a liberal euphemism for bombing. So the poll – I did a study of the top 100 newspapers and their editorial boards, and 50 out of 47, 39 supported the airstrikes, one opposed, and the remainder were kind of ambiguous or unclear. So about 83% of those who weighed an opinion on it, 83% of the editorial boards that had an opinion supported it. MSNBC, for the first 4 hours or so of the bombing, didn't have one voice that leveled a criticism against it. It wasn't until they gave Chris Hayes around 12:30 at night, he had one guy come on and say, well, maybe this isn't such a swell idea. So, and of course you had Brian Williams on air orgasms that were basically playing B-roll of the DOD launching missiles. They of course never show the missiles landing or what they look, what they actually hit, or what happens afterwards. But they got some glorious footage that Brian Williams loved. Trump knows that if he wants the media to get on his side and to kind of start, quote unquote, saying he's presidential, whatever that means, sort of a silly tautology, since he already is president, that he needs to bomb the baddies and. That's kind of the signals they're sending, and that's obviously a very perverse incentive scheme. And of course, you had some liberals like Joyann Reid who were complaining he didn't kill enough Russians. So the criticism wasn't that we had a Republican president starting a new front, a new theater of war, which typically one would think would be a liberal objection. It was, no, indeed, he didn't do it enough. So this is the weird, bizarre world we live in now.
The media reaction to Trump's congressional address in February really seemed to anticipate this, in the sense that Trump was effusively praised, one, for not acting like a total maniac in terms of the general standards of Trump maniacness, but also in particular because he said nice things about a soldier who he had sent to his death in Yemen. And Van Jones had some comments on this that were particularly reprehensible and were the sort of first instance that I'm aware of Trump being called presidential for being militaristic.
We are blessed to be joined tonight by Corinne Owens, the widow of U.S. Navy Special Operator, Senior Chief William Ryan Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation.
He became president of the United States in that moment, period. There are a lot of people who have a lot of reason to be frustrated with him, to be fearful of him, to be mad at him. But that was one of the most extraordinary moments you have ever seen in American politics, period.
Yeah, that's presidential synonymous with being militaristic. It's the there's a kind of machoism, and you see this, unfortunately, you see this kind of doubly with female presidential candidates, where they have to be bellicose and have to talk about blowing things up, and that's synonymous with being taken seriously. There is a very kind of primitive id-like fetishization of the military in our culture that views war making as being presidential and everything else as being, you know, they use terms like the world stage, you know, which is of course a kind of like macho, like everyone's watching, you know, send a signal, send a message. These are all sort of playground type logic that we use to talk about foreign policy. But they're taken for granted because most of the people who write these things and are elevated to positions of influence and pungentry are very lockstep. They're very nationalistic. They're typically venal. They're not very smart. And this is the kind of people who egg on a president like Trump, who, you know, 10 minutes ago they were saying was this crazy madman who can't be trusted. And then suddenly he starts bombing people and then he's therefore presidential. So, again, it's a very pernicious incentive scheme we've created, where anything that involves macho chest beating and bombing things is good, and everything else is waffling and flip-flopping and uncertain.
And the incentives are particularly dangerous when it comes to Trump. Alex Preen wrote a great piece about this after his congressional address, because even though he spends so much time pissing so many people off, he is an incredibly profound narcissist who really wants to be loved and likes being praised. So when the media, who's been beating up on him all this time, suddenly you know, just gives him this warm embrace around anything militaristic, it's a message that he's going to receive loud and clear.
Yeah, it's a total moral hazard, and it is right now the status quo. And again, you have Joanne Reed criticizing a Republican president for not killing Russians, regardless of how we got here. That is completely batshit. That is not a healthy place to be. And that, I think that'll continue to haunt us as we move forward. And, you know, if there's some other inciting incident that the Syrian government decides to do, or rather that they're accused of doing, then we're going to have even more of this. And, you know, we're in a situation now where the only way that Trump can disprove that he's a Manchurian candidate is by greasing Russians. And I think that's a dangerous place to be.
Well, I think Joanne Reed in the past has revealed that she believes it's actually the Soviet Union, not Russia.
Yeah, she I think twice said that they were communist, and she also had said that she also routinely refers to the KGB, even though that hasn't been around in 30 years.
To me, one thing that's fascinating and, you know, scary about all of this is that it's not only a reflection of the media's soft spot for militarism, but very revealing in terms of what the mainstream media and establishment politicians often find so objectionable about Trump, which is more his contempt for decorum and establishment wisdom than his totally atrocious policies.
Yeah, there's a huge premium put on form over substance. So, for example, David Frum wrote a piece that was about 8,000 words long about Trump's authoritarianism that a bunch of people sort of breathlessly shared on. You have to read this. This is a must read. And I guarantee you only 4% of them actually read the thing. This is true with most long reads. People don't actually read it. And they say, oh, you have to read this. It's about authoritarianism. Now, this is written by a guy who invented the term axis of evil and was one of the main champions in messaging stewards of the war in Iraq that ended up killing 1 million people. This is someone who just last week reinforced his belief that marijuana should be illegal, writing about authoritarianism, which is a joke. So they have to come up with this kind of carve out, this moral carve out, where Trump is this unique one-off threat to democracy but you can't really, but you have to make it digestible to quote unquote both sides. So you have to sort of indemnify the Republican Party. And this is something that Clinton did in the campaign, where she decided to distance Trump from the Republican Party, which in retrospect, I think was a tremendous mistake. Not the least of which being because it's not true. He is a natural, logical, and organic extension of the Republican Party, with the exception of maybe one or two issues. And I think that when you try to do that, you have to begin to focus on form and on formality and on you know, we can embrace dictators and we can fund Saudi Arabia and we can sell them arms. And we can support their bombing of their killing of tens of thousands of people in Yemen, but we can't do it overtly, or we can't be too nice. You know, we can support the basically Fourth Reich in Turkey. We can put our weapon systems there and our military bases there, and they can be a part of NATO. But you can't overtly be nice to them. So there's a premium that's put on formality and like the pretense of human rights. That is more important than substance, and that Trump broke those protocols, and that really kind of offended or undermined the liberal order of things, because the liberal order, especially when it comes to human rights, is largely theater. It's not remotely consistent. International law is arbitrarily used. The U.S. wipes its ass with international law as a general rule, and so Trump comes along and says, "Well, okay, like it's all BS anyway. So what's the big deal?" And this kind of gets to the core of like of how the national security establishment rationalizes its existence on a moral level. And I think that he's doing it for all the wrong reasons. Don't get me wrong. He's not like, you know, some noam Chomsky type who's trying to like tease out American hypocrisy, but he's sort of doing away with all the sort of, you know, Davos pretenses. And I think that really kind of is an existential threat to a sort of mythology that you see. And so I think the normal sort of healthy reaction is to say, okay, well, Trump's doing this for all the wrong reasons, but let's not act like, human rights are not arbitrarily applied. Let's not act like international law is not arbitrarily applied. The reaction from others is, oh my gosh, you know, the great Pax Americana is being undermined. Let's all pearl clutch like it's the end of the world. And I think that's kind of been frustrating for leftists to watch, because liberals are clamoring to hold on to this mythology that is, I think, deeply toxic and not at all tethered to reality.
One issue that you've written or commented a bit about is media coverage of Trump's alleged Russia ties. What's your problem with how this has been covered? There do seem to be some things that need to be investigated, but what do you think that the correct approach to this subject that would avoid slipping into a new Red Scare, what would that look like?
My problem is one of proportionality, which is to say that I do think there's an underlying story in the Russia issue. There is a lot of smoke. There are connections between especially Page and Manafort that are like material. They're not, but the sort of main question is, was the Trump campaign conspiring with the Russian government to undermine the Clinton campaign in a way that was involved illegal hacking? And that so far has not been proven. That should be investigated. There should be a special prosecutor that investigates this that I have never objected to. That seems completely reasonable. To the extent to which one accepts the premises of national sovereignty, the United States, as much as I may detest it in its foreign policy, of course it has a right to protect its elections. That seems reasonable to me. The problem is that in the absence of any kind of rock solid evidence, and in the absence, frankly, of Trump not releasing his taxes, which I think is the main issue here. And I think to the extent that the Trump Russia story has spiraled out of control, I think Trump takes a plurality, if not a majority of the fault for that. We've begun to kind of plug things in and to indulge a kind of dot connecting that I don't think we would have otherwise accepted. And the Russia story is also incredibly flattering to the national security establishment. And that's also a very dangerous place to be. When you have a controversy that fuels the war machine, it becomes far more tempting to emphasize it. than it does to not emphasize it. For, you know, for example, Rachel Maddow, I think over half of her coverage has been Russia related.
Wow.
There was one study that was done at The Intercept. Now, should it be zero? No. Should it be 53%? Probably not. Let's say, you know, back of the napkin math, Chris Hayes does, you know, covers it about 10% of the time. That seems reasonable. I don't know. Maybe that's about right. So I think that, you know, the underlying issue is that whenever you criticize the Russia disproportionality, people will say, oh, you don't think it's an issue or you've been downplaying it. But that's not what's going on. You know, the Soviet Union during the Red Scare actually had infiltrated parts of American society. The Soviet Union, it did have active measures within the U.S. This is sort of widely accepted. It doesn't mean there wasn't a Red Scare. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a disproportionate focus and obsession with it that, at the expense of everything else. And I do think that that does exist in a lot of liberal media. And I'm afraid, I'm going to concern troll here a bit, but I'm afraid that by putting a huge focus on that, there does start to have opportunity cost. You do start to lose focus on other things.
Yes.
You do start to lose focus on other things, bad things that are Trump are doing. You do start to disincentivize looking at the existential state of the Democratic Party in the wake of the loss. And I do think that there's a huge danger there. And, you know, I try to reach a balance. I don't like people say, oh, well, Russia didn't do it. Well, you don't know that. We don't know if Russia hacked the DNC. You can't say that for sure either way. It seems like something that we should investigate in due course and not really make any bold claims either way. I don't know. My standard of evidence hasn't really changed. I've had the same standard of evidence since June of last year when the story broke. And the reality is that there's actually been no new evidence. There's been no new evidence that Russia hacked the DNC since the original CrowdStrike report. The DNI report in January didn't have any new information. So they just keep repeating things over and over again. And my standard of evidence has not changed one iota. And that's that people will read that as being somewhat in denial because there's this kind of drumbeat that goes on. And if you don't go along with the drumbeat, you're somehow deluded or covering your ears to the truth or something. So if and when there is like more rock solid evidence, then I'll be the first person to say this is a big story. But I don't, you can't assume there's this huge fire because there's a little bit of smoke. I don't know. Maybe I'm being daft, but I'm happy to hear criticism from others on that issue.
No, I agree entirely. I mean, from what I can see at this moment is that Carter Page looks like a dupe. If he was instrumentalized in any way,
sure.
The way that the Russian agents are allegedly spoke about him was that he was a easily manipulated dupe rather than some sort of secret agent man, double agent. And then Manafort and Stone do seem authentically sketchy and deserving of investigation. But insofar as Trump himself is concerned, what boggles my mind is how little attention mainstream outlets seem to pay to the more obvious explanation for why Trump and Putin have, or at least had, so much affection for one another, which is that they're both right-wing, masculinist, xenophobic nationalists, rather than it being anything about any kind of illegal, underhanded right. Quid pro quo pact.
Because what's the one other thing that Trump breaks on with Republican orthodoxy? There's two things. The bellicosity with Russia, which is taken for granted on the right. And the second one is the TPP. Now, no one has an exotic conspiratorial explanation for the TPP. We've sort of just overlooked it. But the reality is that it's consistent with a Pat Buchanan threat of white nationalist protectionism. That is also consistent with not wanting to start. I mean, again, Pat Buchanan was the biggest, was one of the major opponents to the Iraq war. This is something that has been a thread within white conservatism for a long time. There doesn't really, you know, it's again, the question always boils down to, is it ideological or is it conspiratorial? And ideology, it's sometimes hard to tell the difference, right? Especially in my job, media criticism. But I think when in doubt, ideology is typically the more elegant answer.
Yeah. I mean, Richard Spencer didn't praise Russia as he said something like the last great defender of white civilization because Russia hooked up the election for Trump, but because he right. models certain types of behavior and symbolism that's extremely appealing to white nationalists. It's pretty obvious.
Right. And of course, Putin is very good at kind of playing all sides in a way. He is not like a doctrinaire white nationalist, but he does know how to push those buttons that a lot of white nationalists like. So yeah, I think that again, I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I you know, it very well could, but I just don't, you know, I don't know how much longer it's supposed to go on. You know, I don't know what the end looks like. Now there are reporters at the New York Times and the Washington Post and other places doing, you know, investigating this around the clock 24 hours a day. And I think that's good. I think they should do that. But the sort of professional dot connectors that take, you know, random tidbits of original reporting and kind of stick them together into this other narrative, I think can be a bit diluted and a bit kind of, it becomes a kind of fantasy, you know. It becomes its own sort of internal world of fanfic where, you know, the people who every day are like, oh, Trump's going to get, you know, he's going to have to resign within a week or two. And it's like, no, that's just not going to happen. Like, it seems like it's not at all related to reality.
Hey, this is Dan Denver. You might recognize me from such podcasts as the one you were just listening to. I want to thank you, the listeners, for supporting us on Patreon. I'm a journalist who has spent the last decade covering politics, criminal justice, and immigration at the local and national level. Your support makes it possible for me to do this new podcast venture as a part-time job and to pay all the lovely people who help me out. If you haven't already, please go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com and look up The Dig. $5 a month is a huge help. That's roughly the equivalent of either 5 McDonald's coffees, 1 pour-over, 0.004 ounces of Glenn Beck's gold, or 0 of the bitcoins that the libertarians who don't listen to the show are hoarding to spend on Peter Thiel's island. Your support helps me buy the peanut butter and pay the rent that I need to play my humble role in building socialist politics in the United States. And we have loads of socialist swag on offer. So check it out, patreon.com. Thank you, and back to the show.
Tell me a little bit about former British Tory MP Louise Mensch, who's become a major peddler of Russia-related conspiracy theories on Twitter.
You've also claimed that President Putin had Andrew Breitbart murdered to pave the way for Steve Bannon. This was the man who founded the Breitbart website, to pave the way for Steve Bannon to play a key role in the Trump administration. You then said that Mr. Bannon is behind bomb threats to Jewish community centers. I mean, aren't you in danger of just peddling wild conspiracy theories?
No, first of all, I haven't. And no matter how many times people say this, it's not going to be true. I said on Twitter in a tweet, I believe that to be the case about the murder of Andrew Breitbart.
Well, that's what
and
I just said.
But you it's not a piece of... It's not,
you,
no,
you
no,
believe
I didn't.
President
no,
Putin
I
murdered
didn't.
Him, don't you?
Andrew, I said, I believe it. You said I reported it. Those are two completely different
things.
Well,
you things. Put it out on it's Twitter. You said you believed it. And you don't have a shred of evidence.
I do.
And then there's the game theory guy. Like, what's going on with all of this? I don't pay enough attention to Twitter to understand, but these people
right. Well, you lead a healthy life, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I try.
Leave it to weird, manic Twitter users like me.
But they are having a lot of influence, these people, right?
You know, they this is the thing. Like, you know, I would say just ignore Louise Mensch, but she's on Real Time with Bill Maher. She gets op-eds in the New York Times, which are notoriously difficult to get. Like, it's not like she's a nobody. She has a rather large platform, and she has a large platform with people who have a large platform, which is something that can't be underrated. And she's completely off the rails. I mean, BuzzFeed, our mainstream outlet, BuzzFeed finally noted that she's accused everyone of being a Russian agent. Finally, that there's been a kind of backlash in the more mainstream media, I guess. And she's blamed Russia for the London attack on March 22nd. She's blamed them for the attempt to attack in Sweden last month, or this month rather. She's blamed them for sending a strobe gift to Kirk Eichenwald. She's blamed the Russians for hacking her Wi-Fi in her neighborhood. I mean, these things should be
The murder of Andrew Breitbart.
The murder of Andrew Breitbart. I mean, these things should be prima facie like discrediting, and they're not, for reasons that I can't possibly grasp. And she sort of crossed a line 2 weeks ago when she accused Black Lives Matter of being Russian quote unquote active. because that has some institutional support within the sort of normal liberal media, but or at least superficially, the sort of more corporate DRE wing does. And that was pushback, and she kind of tried to play that off. And then she accused the other day Casey Mitchell, who's this kind of sleazy writer for the Daily Beast who accuses everyone of being pro-Putin, and they're starting to eat their own children. This is someone who she, who Sarah Kendzior or and her should be aligned with. He accused me of being sympathetic to Nazis because I defended RT. I mean, this guy's a total scumbag. And she accused him of being a Russian FSB, or rather the publication he wrote for. And it's like, when does it stop? It's like when they accused Eisenhower of being a communist, or when McCarthy accused Eisenhower of being a communist. Now, I don't use the term McCarthyist because I think it's a very specific historical meaning. But I do think it's useful sometimes to note when people are – to draw parallels when it does – I think someone like Louise Mensch is overtly McCarthyist. The only difference is, of course, that Louise Mensch isn't the U.S. government. That's the major difference, right, which is why I don't really use the term. But yeah, it's completely I think the thing with Louise Mensch is that I think she's a symptom of a broader disease, and I think she's useful to discuss in that context, which is to say she's symptomatic of a lowering of editorial standards the Russia story has resulted in. We would normally not accept someone like this and do proper kind of liberal discourse, but because she's feeding the narrative and kind of getting those juices flowing, and it's anything that makes Trump look bad is being taken for granted. I think that it's part of a broader lowering of editorial standards that I think is actually bad.
And it's a lowering of editorial standards, but also sort of a lowering of critical standards in many liberal, just everyday individuals' minds of a sort that people, including myself, like typically thought of as kind of unique to the far right InfoWars fringe in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that she's the reason why it bothers me on a moral level, because I also feel like she's legitimately playing off the fears of low information Democratic partisans who, don't necessarily follow these things closely and maybe aren't the most skeptical media consumers. And I think she deliberately panders to those people in a way that's kind of cynical. And the only parallels I can really draw are in Alex Jones, because, most people, or maybe let's say a significant minority of people who listen, think, oh, okay, I'm kind of tongue in cheek. I'm sort of aware that this is bullshit. But there's people who buy this stuff and who legitimately think that, what did she say the other day? Orrin Hatch is going to become president and elect and appoint. I mean, this is insane, but people believe this stuff, and it's just, I don't know. It's kind of sad. It's kind of mean. It's exploitative, and it's the people who've, I think, boosted that and promoted her and looked the other way, I think should be ashamed of themselves, because I do think there's lots of collateral damage here.
And your hunch is that she's cynical rather than crazy.
Oh yeah, she's absolutely cynical. I'm completely convinced she's aware of that. She's full of shit and doesn't care. She's constantly winking and nodding. I think she goes to bed every night saying, "I got away with it again."
One thing I've never seen explained really is, regardless of who did the DNC hacks, why on earth it would have decisively shaped the outcome of the election. There are so many things, obviously, that the Clinton campaign did to fuck up, and things that Trump did to win. And then in terms of external factors, it seems to me that the Comey letter was a much, much, much bigger and more obvious culprit in terms of swinging the election.
It's impossible to say. I think that if it was indeed Russia who hacked the DNC in alliance with WikiLeaks, and then selectively released one side, that seems like a classic psychological operations thing to do. I think it probably would have had a negative effect. Whether or not it would have cost the election, I don't know. But it seems a bit naive to say it doesn't, in the aggregate, have an effect. And to the extent to which it was weaponized by the kind of more pro-Bernie crowd who were still bitter from the DNC, yeah, that seems likely. Again, I don't know if Russia did it or not, but if they did do it, that seems like that's a here's a good way of looking at it, okay? If a foreign government had hacked the DNC and Bernie would have won the nomination and selectively leaked it against Bernie, would we necessarily be that blasé about it? Probably not. Let's take it one step further. If the Clinton campaign had hacked Bernie's emails and selectively leaked things, we would probably be incensed and outraged. So I want to be fair with like having a consistent standard. I think that if indeed Russia did that, it would indeed be a form of psychological warfare or whatever. It's important to note, however, of course, America does this all the time. So I don't think it's sort of below board or kind of beyond the moral pale. This is something that the United States routinely does. We routinely run psychological operations to try to influence elections, including domestically. So that seems like a totally fair gripe to have from the Clinton campaign. If indeed it was Russia, sure, I think that's fair. Now, is it worse than the Comey letter? I don't think so, simply because of the timing. I think the fact that the Comey letter was 10 days before the election probably had a more demonstrable effect. And I wrote about it on the morning of the election. I was like, I cannot believe that the media mindlessly repeated that it was this huge scandal. It was actually shocking to me because the media was broadly in the tank for Clinton, almost without exception. But they have a weak spot for scandal, I think, that kind of supersedes any partisan loyalty. And they're mindlessly going, oh my gosh, the Comey letter, it's the emails. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me that they're running with this like it's this huge deal. And of course, there was nothing behind this. There was no substance behind the letter. There was no new scandal. There was no new information.
All it said is we've discovered new emails. We have no idea what they say that are pertinent to the investigation. And lo and behold, a week later, nothing there.
I thought what Comey did was borderline. I mean, I wouldn't say criminal, but it was ethically very, very, very bad. And it should probably cost him his job, but it won't because the guy he helped win.
And as the Times reported recently in a kind of deep dive into the Comey letter, that he explicitly didn't release similar information about the status of investigations into the Trump campaign. So, I mean, that makes things even more weird.
Yeah, I think here's the more logical explanation, which is everybody assumed Clinton would win anyway, and that Comey wanted to look objective in the event that they eventually investigated Trump. That seems like a pretty logical explanation to me. But then, of course, the unexpected happened, and I think that my guess is that if Comey could do it over again, he probably wouldn't have done that. But that was completely negligent. There's no other word, but just it's depraved indifference is what it is. I mean, this is a man of tremendous influence and power on the eve of a major important election that's going to affect thousands and thousands and millions of vulnerable populations, LGBT, Muslims, and he's more worried about his image and his career and the appearance of objectivity. And he's this above the fray type guy than he has the material effect on an election. I think he should be ashamed of himself.
Earlier we spoke about the incentive scheme set up by the media cheering for Trump taking military action. Do you think that another incentive scheme, a parallel or intersecting incentive scheme, was also at play in terms of driving him to attack Syria, and that being the incentive to tell all the people calling him a Putin stooge, look, I just attacked Putin's top ally. In fact, I attacked an airbase with Russian troops on it.
Yeah. whether or not that's by design, I don't know. That's above my pay grade, but
it seemed to have worked, right?
Yeah. We're in a situation now where you have the nominally liberal, nominally opposition party, egging and begging and prodding a Republican president to be more aggressive towards a country with 2,900 nuclear warheads. Whether or not that's by design, I don't know, but you sure as hell couldn't have designed it better. if I'm the war machine. Not bombing Russia is now a sign of complicity with, when they first broke the news that Russia had notified, or rather that Trump had notified the Russians, and these liberal drooling, like knee-jerk dipshits on Twitter were like, oh my God, he let him know. I literally smashed my head against the keyboard, because like anyone who knows anything about the history of American and Russian relations knows you always let Russia know because you don't want to kill Russian soldiers. In Afghanistan,
you don't want to turn a proxy war into an actual war between the superpowers.
In the 1980s, the CIA would bend over backwards to direct the Mujahideen not to use their weapons to attack Russians because they didn't want that to come back to them. The idea of deconflicting with Russians is something that has existed for decades. But suddenly when Trump did it, it was further evidence of a conspiracy. And this kind of myopia and this kind of ahistoric contextualization of the Russian-American relationship was really, really dangerous. Because again, now you're prodding a Republican president to want to bomb Russians. And the only way he can prove his loyalty to his country is by bombing more Russians. And the fact that people don't see the moral hazard here continues to shock me.
The media framing of conflicts in Syria, in Yemen, in other places, they seem to be framed in such a way that only certain solutions seem plausible as a result of the reporting. What's your take on the current coverage of those two conflicts, and what sort of policy prescriptions they're implicitly pushing?
Well, the Syria conflict is, I would argue, one of the most, the reason why I started writing about Syria wasn't because I had any unique, when I started off, I wasn't necessarily trying to. I just, as a media critic, I'm drawn to bullshit. And so I go where the most bullshit is. And the most bullshit per capita of anything is how the media covers Syria. Ann Barnard, who's a reporter for the New York Times, just the other day they have these things called news analysis, which the New York Times allows their reporters to effectively write opinion pieces, which is good because you get to find out what they really think instead of their thinly veiled arguing. So she wrote this piece that it did the standard thing that the media has been doing since the beginning of the war, which is that America has, quote unquote, done nothing, that we've stood by. They need to paint this Rwanda narrative about Syria, where the U.S. sits there and allows this merciless slaughtering going on, but we do nothing. Now, in fact, the CIA has been involved in the war since at least 2012. They've been involved with it directly since 2013. The Washington Post says they spend $1 billion a year training anti-Assad rebels and anti-SAA rebels. Now, this was, of course, omitted from her piece about us doing nothing. She said, quote, Obama kept the war at arm's length, which is, of course, a total fantasy, to say nothing of America's biggest allies in the region, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, which have been arming and funding groups to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars more, depending who you ask. The idea that the U.S. has done nothing in Syria or has not been involved in the war is probably the single most popular and most pernicious lie about that war. Because the implication is that we need to do more. We need to directly bomb the Syrian government, because that's the desires of lots of people, fair or not. And that mythology that America has done nothing, that Obama did nothing, is still very prevalent, although it's gotten less prevalent. I feel like the media has sort of mentioned it at least a little bit more recently. And I think that the implication being, again, with the Rwanda do nothing narrative that's pushed by everybody from Joe Scarborough to Nick Kristof, is America needs to bomb and overthrow the Syrian government.
And it's never really explained how exactly that's going to lead to something, an outcome that's less disastrous than every other time we pursue regime change.
It never is. The counter argument they usually say is, oh, well, we did regime change in Libya, and that, it's a war zone with half the country controlled by jihadists. And they're now selling slaves. But at least it's not Syria. At least, they throw out the 500,000 number. That counterfactual would only be fair if we actually did do nothing in Syria. But we didn't do nothing in Syria. Had the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Turkey actually done nothing in Syria, it's very likely, and it's impossible to say one or the other, but the war would have been over very soon, which is to say that the Assad government would have clamped down and tortured and killed people and ended the war. Now, that would be bad, but would it be better than killing 500,000 people? I don't know. You make that decision. The quote unquote do something crowd, which is always telling you to do something. Of course, they never say what exactly that is. has been pushing for America to intervene on behalf of the opposition for you know, 5 years since it began. And it's, you know, it's the usual suspects. It's the neoconservatives. It's the cruise missile liberals, your Amory Slaughters, your Nicholas Kristofs. But they can never tell you what the government's supposed to replace it with, since the vast majority of the opposition is Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda linked. Now, there are secular Democrats within the opposition. They're just not that many of them. And they're not a meaningful force on the ground. And any neutral or sober observer of the conflict will tell you that. Now, so the implication is that if and when we actually did overthrow the Assad government, effectively the United States and NATO in general would become the government of Syria. We would do what we did in Libya, where we basically take over and run the government, with maybe some help from the United Nations. So that's what they want.
It seems like another upshot of the U.S. hasn't done anything narrative is that it obscures the broader proxy war that's going on with the Sunni regimes in the U.S. on the one side and
Israel,
Iran, and Israel, and then Iran, Russia on the other. Because once you start looking at it through the lens of this regional proxy war that outside powers are deeply involved with, both sides start looking pretty horrible, and it's harder to paint the picture of it being a freedom struggle versus a horrible dictator when you have Saudi Arabia involved.
We like neat moral narratives. We like the idea of the evil dictator versus the scrappy rebel, and the idea that America has stood by as they've done nothing, because again, we want a Rwanda 2.0. But reality asserts itself, and reality doesn't like moral narratives. It doesn't like neat narratives, and there is nothing less neat and nothing less morally clear than I think what's going on in Syria. And I think that the media has tried to a large degree, from BuzzFeed to Vice to The Guardian — God, The Guardian's probably the worst — to The New York Times, to The Washington Post, with some rare exceptions, has been really holding on to a mythology. And a lot of that's systemic. A lot of that's because there is no actual reporting in Syria, because you can't go to Syria. You'll be kidnapped and ransomed. And you can't go if you go to the government-controlled areas, they'll call you an Assad stooge and ruin your career. So there's no actual reporting in Syria. You know, Anne Barnett reports about Syria from about two blocks where I lived, in Hamra, in Beirut. And it's not to say she's not a good reporter who has lots of contacts there, but like, you have to understand that there are filters that exist within Syria that the American and Western journalists are getting a very specific kind of narrative. And that's just the reality of the situation. I don't think necessarily that means that they're all, you know, acting in bad faith, but it's just the nature of the conflict. So there's that thrown on top of it. And I think that leads to a very warped view of what's going on there. And it's something that's hard to talk about on the left, because it's such a third rail, as many have seen, because they'll call you a dictator lover or an Assadist or whatever if you kind of are somewhat skeptical of that narrative. And I think that it's led lots of otherwise smart people to kind of shut their mouths about the topic, I think. And I've had people tell me this offline.
Well, seeing acknowledging the lack of moral clarity on the various sides of this in no way requires any sort of rehabilitation of the Assad regime, which is the nature of which is pretty obvious. And the fact.
Well, yeah, we always have to check that box, don't we? Okay, yeah, sure. Let's check that box. Go ahead.
Well, this is continuing our debate from when we saw each other in person. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea in terms of just describing the situation to accurately describe how much one thinks various sides of a conflict suck. I don't think it's so much a box checking, but just more of an empirically. But you think it's dangerous to do that?
It's not that it's dangerous. Is that I'm not in a position to morally judge anyone in the conflict. For example, like, there are people who legitimately hate the government, who've joined Al Qaeda, who are not these cartoon Wahhabist head choppers that, you know, the other side makes them out to be. These are people who are operating because Al Qaeda is the only game in town. They join Al Qaeda. I would never like go to that Syrian whose family was tortured by Assad and be like, "How dare you? You know, you're Al Qaeda." right? That's not a very like materialist way of looking at the conflict. Just as I wouldn't go to a Shia or Alawi or a Christian who's a supporter of Assad and say, you're an Assadist, right? That's an absurd like moralizing of the conflict. Because I have no standing. I'm not Syrian. I have no standing. All I have standing in is what my government does and what my government has done, because that's what I have influence over and that's what I pay for.
But reporters have standing to tell the truth as best as they can. And I agree with your criticism of very much of the mainstream framing of it. But I don't think that precludes. In fact, I think it requires an assessment, an honest assessment of the Assad regime.
But again, it's okay. So you're the 750th person to jump on the football. Congratulations. Like, it's the whole point of in my opinion, the point of writing in general or reporting in general is to say something new, not to just reinforce what is sort of widely accepted. Like, I mean, again, I've met people in Syria whose family was arbitrarily detained in Lebanon, whose family was arbitrarily detained and likely tortured by the Assad government. Like, you can't really go anywhere in the Middle East without meeting a Syrian who's had some episode like that. That is generally true. And that should not be eliminated from the broader conversation. But there's a kind of moral pornography that goes on with how people talk about Syria that does deal in binaries. And I don't see a lot of use in running through the motions on that. On either side, I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit of a both sides guy here, but I feel like it's kind of a running through the motions kind of thing that I find to be a bit tedious, especially since, you know, there is some asymmetry in who has done what in that conflict. It's like the piece that was in The Intercept the other day that said, you know, Hezbollah was asked by Iran to interfere in the war, which is kind of goofy if you understand the war. Hezbollah was involved in the war, when they'll tell you their reasons, and it had a lot more to do with the fact that they were legitimately concerned that Salafists and Al Qaeda were going to literally run over Beirut as they did Mosul and Raqqa, which was a legitimate fear at that time. I don't know. It's definitely messy.
I want to shift gears to the general matter of Trump's and Spicer's war with the mainstream press. What do you make of the origins of that feud and what interests it serves on both sides?
Well, I mean, imagine being Donald Trump's press secretary. I mean, you literally could not pay me any amount of money to do that job. What a humiliating, morally and intellectually impossible job to do. Sean Spicer is clearly
the ultimate,
not a very smart guy.
And the ultimate cuck.
Is the ultimate cuck. We'll do the job he's told to do because he's probably getting a decent paycheck and he knows he can probably do like the right wing media circuits for the next. Yeah, I mean, Trump lies all the time about things that are demonstrably false, even more so than other politicians. You know, politicians have always lied, but Trump has taken it to, I think, a meaningfully different higher level of just outright saying things that are obviously not true. They contradict themselves all the time. He deals in, I mean, I don't just imagine doing that. I mean, it's an impossible job, and Spicer is already kind of a moron. So, I don't know. I mean, the press hates Spicer because the press hates Trump, and they hate Trump for good reason. You know, I oftentimes say that the press hates Trump, and I don't mean that as like a victimization thing, because I mean the press hates cancer. I mean, some things are just objectively bad, and it's okay that the press hates Trump. You couldn't pay me any amount of money to do that guy's job.
It does seem like Trump has encouraged some positive developments in the mainstream media, like the New York Times deciding to call Trump's birtherism a lie. And
yeah, took him a while. Yeah. But they did it.
There's always been this fantasy in mainstream newspaper journalism, obviously, about objectivity and balance. But as you said, the media always hates cancer. Any investigative piece in a newspaper is always premised on the idea that wrongdoing is being uncovered and thus is making a clear opinion putting a clear opinion forward about something being wrong.
Yeah, I think the one silver lining of Trump is that he has effectively ended the myth of objectivity in journalism, which is always a very precarious myth. But he's exposed it as the complete like moral fraud that it is, and now people are saying, okay, you know, we need to aggressively attack power instead of splitting the difference with person X and person Y. I think that's probably good, assuming that it lasts longer than his term in office. I think that's good.
Let's talk about fake news. Obviously, it's been reappropriated by Trump and the Chinese government for cynical ends. But you think it was a bit of a problem concept from the get-go, right?
Yeah, it's been. Trust me when I tell it. Yeah, it's always those evil Chinese that do it, right? No, we did it way before. The term is bullshit and was bullshit by design from the beginning. So there was this kind of general idea that there were these weird spammy websites that were publishing stories that were objectively false. That, you know, Trump, the Pope endorses Trump or something goofy like that. We can look at that and say that's objectively not true, right? Then about 10 minutes after the fake news thing happened as a sort of moral panic, mostly from BuzzFeed and the New York Times, right before the election, actually, it was a few days, maybe like a week or two before the election, it suddenly morphed into any news I don't like really fast. It was not Trump that first abused it. It was corporate media that first abused it. And then it really hit its peak on November 24th, a few weeks after the election, when the Washington Post published a list of Russian fake news websites that included Consortium News, Naked Capitalism, Black Agenda Report, everything from the Drudge Report to Truth Dig and Truth App. They did so without irony. They did so without skepticism. They did so with a straight face. The first time Trump used fake news as a pejorative was 2 weeks later, on roughly December 10th. The term had already been killed and abused before the evil Chinese and the Trump regime got their hands on it, because the term was as a sort of unique moral panic was always bullshit to begin with. It was a post-election scapegoat. It was largely a way for mainstream outlets to, I think, snuff out and delegitimize alternative media sources. And, you know, there may be some more sinister intentions as well. I don't know. But the definition of fake news became any news I don't like within about 10 minutes.
But the original definition did refer to something real, right? Which is like the guys who are in their basements fabricating these stories to make
yes
money,
and no.
Right?
Because the edge cases were pretty clear from the beginning. So, for example, the canonical study people refer to is this BuzzFeed study that was done on November 16th about and the headline is "Fake News Overperformed Real News in the Weeks Leading Up to the Election." The obvious implication being is that the fake news cost Hillary the election. That's the obvious implication, right? Now, the examples they gave 19 examples, and they used a very slippery term called overperforming. Or outperforming, rather. What they don't note is that there's still vastly more "quote unquote" real news than there is fake news, and that they took the top 20 of each without letting people know that one example probably had 50 stories and the other had thousands of stories. So they're already sort of like the way that fake news is being reported was constantly being disingenuous.
Extremely misleading methodology.
Extremely misleading methodology. And then there was another study that BuzzFeed uses where they had a few examples from a website called endingthefed.something or other. And they had five of those stories and they used those examples. But the reality is one of those stories was actually true. It was about an email that Clinton had sent that was released by WikiLeaks, where she said that Qatar and Saudi Arabia had funded ISIS. Now, that was a real email she had sent. It was a security briefing that some people think was probably Sid Blumenthal, but that was a real story. That was not fake. That was not a fake story. It was from a website that consistently published fake stories, but that specific story was actually true. So there's a lot of false positives from the beginning that were kind of, now of course they had all their like weird libertarian like editorializing, but the underlying story was in fact true. And so from the beginning you had a kind of very, very slippery slope. Whereas like in the wake of 9/11, I can look at terrorism and say, that's terrorism. That makes sense to me. But we passed a ton of laws and you know, instilled a lot of social
you know, a lot of words and a lot of social constructs that would haunt us for the next 20 years about what was and what wasn't terrorism within the weeks after 9/11. And I think we experienced a similar trauma on Election Day, and we kind of rushed to find this scapegoat without really thinking through what the implication was. And so now you have, you know, Facebook putting up flags when people try to post stories, and they're experimenting with it in different ways that say this has been flagged by our fact checkers saying this is fake news, and they do it about 3 or 4 times. Now, I think that when you have what is effectively a monopoly like Facebook determining what is and what isn't true, that it really leads you to a very dangerous place. When it's things like, you know, the Pope endorses Trump, that seems somewhat, you know, clear cut. But, you know, what if I want to publish a story saying that, you know, the Assad regime was set up for the sarin gas attacks? Is that okay? I mean, what if I want to, you know, get into the weeds about whether or not, you know, the invasion of Crimea is? I mean, these things are highly subjective, whether or not they're real or fake. And I think that's, you know, governments have an impulse and large corporations have an impulse to control the flow of information. And anytime there's a rush to control information, we should be highly skeptical of it.
Hey, this is Bhaskar Sankara, editor of Jacobin. I know everyone has a podcast these days, but the Dig and Dan Denver are really, really good. And Dan needs your help to help pay the people who work on the show and reproduce their labor power. And as every Marxist knows, it's very important. To support this show, go to patreon.com and look up The Dig. That's Patreon, PATREON.com. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Speaking of information freakouts, what's up with all the attention being paid to the Russian government-backed outlet RT? I mean, who watches RT in the United States?
Not many people. So it's a very popular article to write where you hand wring about the influence of RT. Jim Ruttenberg, the media analyst for the New York Times, who I call the Jay Leno of media criticism.
Oh my God! Every Monday, I mourn David Carr so hard. It's intense.
You know, he's terrible. So he's done like 75 articles about the dangers of RT, and it's the easy thing you write. It gets, you know, the blue check marks will share with a little bit. Oh my gosh, I can't believe this. But yeah, I mean, look, the Daily Beast said their numbers were less than 30,000 Americans watch the average RT show, which is about 0.3% of the viewership of Judge Judy. So you can take that for what it is. You say, okay, they have some influence on YouTube, maybe, but I think RT probably. I think they fake those numbers too, to be quite frank. So, you know, I could probably go to Times Square and find 100 people, maybe 4 of them know what RT is. I don't think it's that influential. I certainly don't think that the DNI's report about Russian influence in the election should have been 40% about RT. You know, they're making these bold claims about a massive global conspiracy and hacking the DNC. And almost half the report is about Russia Today. I think that, and by the way, it was a report from 2012. They just recycled. I think that's kind of a tad embarrassing. It seems like they're kind of grasping at straws, in my opinion. So, look, RT will be this boogeyman. They also want to stigmatize RT, so you're not on it. They don't want people to go on RT. They want it to be a kind of career ender to work for RT. That's one of the other benefits of constantly panicking about RT.
So now we're going to turn to a listener question.
Hi, Dan. My name's James Frederick. I have a question for Adam Johnson. I'm a reporter also, and I get very frustrated with discussions about whether a reporter should have their own political opinions. I, of course, have my own political opinions and make decisions on that, but I also think I'm a good enough reporter that I can have opinions and also report on facts and make good arguments based on those facts. But I feel like, especially in mainstream or political reporting, there's the idea that reporters shouldn't have opinions, that reporters should be, you know, unbiased in everything. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what the ideal world of this looks like, of reporters who obviously have opinions, can be upfront about those, but can also report well? Thanks.
So I think it's important to note that all reporters almost uniformly have opinions. And they express those opinions. What you're not allowed to have is an opinion that is partisan.
So as long as something is bipartisan, right, you know, the sort of necessity of the war on terror, the evilness of the Russian and Syrian governments, as long as it's sort of a bipartisan consensus, it's completely standard for people to have an opinion. So it isn't that journalists can't have opinions, it's that they can't have opinions that are controversial, and those are not the same thing. So I think that it all depends on what your genre is. I obviously operate in a more opinion punditry genre, so I'm more liberal with my opinions. But the general rule of thumb for reporters about having overtly having political opinions is the degree to which they will offend people who matter. And I think that that is an issue of ingratiating oneself to a certain kind of class of people and getting jobs at certain places. And it has less to do with any kind of objective virtue of being objective, as it were, right?
Finally, I want to turn to the issue of the Overton window in the U.S. press. The New York Times recently named Brett Stevens, the Wall Street Journal's deputy editorial page editor, as a columnist.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. You had some interesting thoughts on the general situation. You wrote, "When one goes to the far right, namely the neocon right, which puts a premium on anti-Arab and anti-Black racism and fetishizes American exceptionalism above all else, there doesn't seem to be a line that can be crossed. This is in stark contrast to the other end of the spectrum, on the spectrum, where anything slightly to the left of Hillary Clinton is non-existent in the staff opinion section of the New York Times. All of the liberal or pro-democratic Times columnists during the 2016 primary, for example, were behind Clinton or, at the very least, not behind Sanders or his broader policy aims. Why, at a time when socialism is becoming so attractive to such a huge number of Americans for the first time in a really long time, does the mainstream commentariat exclude leftists? Especially because it is true, the media is, these mainstream publications are run by liberals. Why are they so much more welcoming of far-right figures than they are to people who they're ostensibly closer to, who are to their left?
Because liberals hate socialists more than they hate fascists. It's really that simple. Liberalism as an ideology exists in relation to power. It is a fundamentally reformist ideology that operates as a safety valve for populist unrest to preserve the status quo. And so the right, and even to some extent Trump, is not really a threat to them in any meaningful way, whereas the left is, because their power stems precisely from their ability to punch left and to guard it, and to guard the left side of the gates and say, this is the appropriate discourse. That's the very design. It's exactly what the New York Times is designed to do.
If you don't mind, I'd like to do a quick New York Times columnist lightning round. Quick thoughts. And if you want to pass, you can pass, and we'll just cut it. So you won't be in, there's no need for embarrassment if you don't have anything to say on anyone in particular.
Okay.
All right, let's start with Brett Stevens.
Brett Stevens is a racist who hates Arabs, and he said they have anti-Semitism was a disease of the Arab mind, and I'm curious if he thinks after 6 million Jews were killed by Europeans, if he also thinks it's a disease of the white mind. But no, he's a run of the mill anti-Arab racist and far right climate denier. I don't know.
Paul Krugman.
Krugman is, to some extent, he's still good. He's also, to a large extent, become everything he used to make fun of. He used to make fun of serious people, and he actually, I think, even used the defense about serious economists when he was bashing Sanders. He has grown more conservative in many ways, and he, the guy's always been a free trade guy. He's always been neoliberal in his core. He's just not as... he's not as mean when it comes to gutting programs for the poor. So he's been almost like a neoliberal. He's about as progressive as he can be while still accepting the tenets of neoliberalism. So I don't know.
It was particularly bizarre to see him embrace Syriza standing up to the Troika so fervently, which was great, and then turn on Sanders so hard the second he gained a following.
I mean, he's a Clinton guy. You know, people get partisan. They get behind candidates, and they that's their deal. I think it's probably just a thing where he was a big Clinton guy, and so he had to sort of contort his ideology around that.
David Brooks.
D-
David Brooks is Northeastern grandfatherly racism mixed with a deeply condescending and patronizing view of black people. Read his column, if you want to understand David Brooks, read his column a week after Katrina, when he talks about how they need to use this opportunity to privatize the schools of New Orleans. It's pretty shockingly racist.
Thomas Friedman
loves charter schools and ISIS.
But you're actually serious and correct about that.
No, he half jokingly suggested we arm ISIS, although I don't think he was actually joking. And then he suggested we not attack them in Syria for the sole purposes of using them as a proxy to kill Hezbollah in Iran. No, he's a classic militant Zionist. He hates Iran more than anything. And if Sunni contras and Sunni proxies want to kill Iranians and Hezbollah, then he's all for it. And yeah, he's a terrible writer, and he basically repeats whatever the Davos crowd wants him to repeat. I don't know.
Maureen Dowd?
I don't read Maureen Dowd. She strikes me as somewhat tedious. I don't know. Although she did surprisingly, she was the only columnist who was remotely critical of the Libyan invasion, surprisingly.
And of the Clintons, I think, generally, if not a Sanders endorsement.
Oh, yeah. Well, the way I describe Maureen Dowd is she manages to criticize Clinton for all the wrong things. Like she criticizes her in very like sexist, like like superficial terms. You know, it's never like, oh, she has bad policies or this. It's like she's kind of a bitch. Like she just doesn't like her. It's weird. Her hatred for Clinton is really unhealthy, and it does come off as
sexist.
Read the stuff she did during Obama. It's pretty sexist. It's like she's too ambitious. She's not likable. I mean, it's bad. It's like pretty bad.
Well, great material from one of the, I believe, two women who have staff columns at the Times. Moving on to the sole non-white.
I like Gil Collins. Gil Collins is harmless. I don't know.
Okay. Well, yeah. So Collins, anything?
She's harmless. I mean, she's pretty like basic. I mean, she doesn't really say anything particularly controversial, but like, you know, boilerplate. Some of her stuff on feminism, I think, is pretty good.
Charles Blow, who I believe is the only non-white person with a Times column.
He's boilerplate Democratic talking point of the week. I don't know. He does have some good stuff on race, but it's usually like hyper-qualified. I don't know.
It is remarkable that for an editorial page so committed to sort of neoliberal identity politics that they can't even bother to have more than one person of color.
Well, I'm just shocked that they have so many opinions about Israel and Palestine, but can never manage to find a Muslim or Arab to write for them.
Remarkable. Well, speaking of savior complexes, Nicholas Kristof.
Nicholas Kristof has basically one job in the world, and it's to find out where the State Department and the DOD wants to interfere with, and then run there and find a humanitarian disaster. That's what Nicholas Kristof does.
Ross Douthat.
He should be writing for the Federalist. He's kind of like, he has a weird fascination with pop culture because he wants to dance around what he really thinks about race and women. So he kind of like talks in code, and he does the David Brooks thing which is what you have to do when you're a conservative who writes for the New York Times, which is reference a lot of books like all the time for no reason, to kind of lend yourself faux gravitas and never really make a point. Because if David Brooks and Ross wanted to like really be honest about what they think, they wouldn't be writing for the New York Times. So they have to like talk in circles, and it just ends up being tedious.
Yeah. If they just began their columns with, why are black people so poor? Well,
yeah,
it's about really time that we ask black people that question. They don't get to write that at the Times. Directly.
Yeah. You have to have your good Northeastern subtle racist Republican columns.
Roger Cohen.
He's okay. It's the same kind of boilerplate, Democratic hawkishness on Iran and Israel, mixed with like, you know, idiosyncratic solipsistic observations about his own life that I don't find particularly interesting.
And lastly, and I find, this person's columns amongst the most perplexing, Frank Bruni.
Frank Bruni should not be writing for the New York Times opinion section. Frank Bruni was an excellent, excellent food critic. In fact, he just completely eviscerated this restaurant I worked at in 2009, and he called the waiters there yummy chew toys who were hard to swallow, which is one of the higher compliments I've ever received in my life. And he was a great food critic, but he's kind of an idiot. His political instincts are confused. I don't know. He doesn't strike me as a very bright guy when it comes to politics.
I guess my last question is, why do we discussed why the left voices are excluded from the Times, the ranks of the New York Times columnists, but why are Times columnists so bad?
It's like NPR. You can't get fired. When everyone tells me that capitalism is a meritocracy, I'm like, well, look at the New York Times. Like, you can't get fired. They just keep wasting away. It's also because they flatter the opinions of the people who subscribe to them. Like, the average newspaper subscriber is older, more conservative, and whiter, and like, that's who they're pandering to, right? It's they're also there to solidify the conventional wisdom of. I mean, if the top 1% of people in the world, income wise, got together and hired a public relations firm, that firm would look indistinguishable from Thomas Friedman. that's what Thomas Friedman does, right? He regurgitates the conventional wisdom of whatever the last billionaire he talked to was, and then he'll oftentimes just promote their companies. That's the function of the New York Times. Like, you're not going to get a leftist voice in the New York Times by definition, which is why you really shouldn't be looking to the New York Times for any kind of, salvation, right?
Adam Johnson, thanks very much.
Yeah, I had a blast.
Adam Johnson is a writer at the leftist press watchdog, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once kind of said, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, engineered by Tristan Rodman, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And if it's on iTunes, leave us a glowing review. Those reviews do help put us in front of new listeners. So does spreading the word to your friends. And please find us on Patreon and make a monthly contribution to keep this thing going. Even a few bucks a month is a big help.